On the Empire Podcast this week, the odds are ever in our favour as we talk to the Lawrence who bestrides the Hunger Games catching fire like a colossus. It is, of course, its director, Francis Lawrence. Why, who else did you think I meant? We also chat to and swear like troopers with two of his stars, Stanley Tucci and Elizabeth Banks. Plus, reviews of Blue is the Warmest Colour, The Family, Parkland and more on the Only Movie Podcast was up all night playing Quiz Up, and frankly is a bit disappointed that there isn't an Empire Podcast category. Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the Empire Podcast. I'm joined this week as ever by three of my learned and esteemed colleagues, cousins, all of whom have changed their names by Deadpool to reflect their new names, their Hunger Games names. First up is a lady so fierce she makes Katniss Everdeen look like Cat Piss Neverdeen. That's pretty much my level. It was Helen O'Hara. It is now Winchester Drool-a-Lot. That's right, I changed him.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
That's, okay. I think, entirely appropriate.
James and I have been arguing about Supernatural this week.
I think
it's not shit. He thinks it is.
No, to be fair, and we've derailed the podcast. We've literally only just started.
Already. You haven't even been introduced. You've derailed it already. What the hell are you doing?
I've watched, I think, six seasons of Supernatural. I watched the entire season on my honeymoon, which is sad and tragic, but what I'm saying is I think this qualifies me to say with affection it's a bit rubbish.
Sorry, how many seasons on your honeymoon?
I watched one season. I watched a season of Supernatural, several episodes of Lie to Me, and the whole of John Adams.
You were doing your honeymoon wrong.
Yes,
really?
He also texted back to recommend a book during
his honeymoon.
Oh,
he did.
Yes,
that's true. I read Patrick Rothfuss's In the Name of the Wind,
and
I texted Helen from the pool to say that she needs to read it.
And how did your ex-wife take it?
Yeah, good
not
times.
An ex-wife. You are still married to your wife.
Good times.
You are still married to your
wife.
All right, next up, you've heard him because he won't stop talking. He's the editor of Empire Online, the man whose colossal vision and barely basic competence makes that site what it is today. He was James Dyer. He is now Earl Notworking. Work it out. Last but not least is the man who stays up into the wee small hours with scissors and tape, putting this podcast together. No need to thank him because we have someone who stays up with him into the wee small hours with more scissors and other tape, making sure that he actually does it. He was Ali Plum. He is now Audacity Out My Hands. Welcome, sir.
And yet again, he's got it wrong.
Have I?
It's Audition.
Is it?
It's still Audition.
Is it Audition? I'll do it again.
No, it's fine.
I'll do it again.
It's fine. Leave it. It's funny
that you keep getting it wrong.
It's funny that you keep getting it wrong.
How do I keep getting that wrong?
I don't know.
Pretty much. All right. My Hunger Games name, by the way, it's Keith Hunger Games' name.
I feel like you ran out of time there, Chris.
I feel like I've gone easy myself.
Yeah.
With that one.
A little bit.
A little
just
bit.
Maybe.
Anyway.
Could I now dub you Galahad Twatalot?
Yes, of course you can.
Excellent.
All right. Let's move on to your questions. You've been sending them in all week on Twitter, Facebook, and email. We have all three this week. Amazing. Let's start with an email question from Simon Crookston, who asks, with Susan from I'm Alan Partridge Series 1 appearing in The Counselor very briefly, what appearances by an actor or actress have caught you most off guard while watching a movie? Another example would be Lieutenant Jim Dangle appearing as the Doctor in The Dark Knight Rises. That's Thomas Lennon, who's in Reno 911, but also he's the co-writer of the Night at the Museum franchise.
He is, yes.
I've got a good one for this.
Go for it.
I think we've mentioned this in the podcast before, but it's a scene in Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull when Indiana Jones walks into a room and is confronted not just with Jim Robinson from Neighbours, whom I was on a flight with recently, but the janitor from Scrubs.
Yes,
that's
right.
That was a weird film for me. And they talk about how Jim Robinson from Neighbours, Alan Dale, talks about how he and Indy were great friends during World War II. And I'm sure I wasn't alone in thinking that that is a movie that I'd much rather watch than the one I was actually watching.
The actor who plays the janitor is called Neil Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
So now you know.
There's a lovely subplot on Scrubs. Essentially, was it Turk, I think, or JD watches the Fugitive, and
yep.
Neil Flynn is in it as a cop towards the end who tries to apprehend the one-armed man on a Chicago subway train. And there's like a whole thing. Is the janitor really Neil Flynn, who's really an actor? And they never quite resolve that. It's wonderful.
George Lucas in Beverly Hills Cop 3.
Yes.
What are you doing? He plays, and this is the best thing about it. If you remember, he is queuing up to get onto the ride called The Spider, and then Axel just jumps in and cuts in and gets in ahead of him, right? In the credits, guess what his character name is?
Mace Windu.
Good shout. It's actually Disappointed Man, which curiously was the character name of everyone in every cinema that was watching that film.
Oh!
Come Zing. On
now. All disappointed woman, to be fair. Yeah. I would also put into this sexist category. Yeah, I know, what a twat I am. Also, Vanilla Ice in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze. What are you doing in that film? Serious question, though. Serious answer is Jay and Silent Bob and Scream 3.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a weird one.
Because then that means it's part of the Viewer Skewniverse, and if that's the case, then all kinds of freaky-deaky shit's going on.
Do cameos count, though? George Lucas, Jay and Silent Bob. I know they kind of do a little bit.
I'm talking about taking you out of the film and kind of make you go, huh? What?
True. But Jim Robinson from Neighbours and the janitor from Scrubs are jobbing actors. They're not cast for their recognition value in Indy 4.
Okay,
they just happen to be in a scene, and they just happen to be two kind of weird character actors.
Eddie Izzard in Ocean's 12.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, that's really fair.
Because his accent's all over the shop, and he's not the best actor. I love him to bits, but he doesn't quite fit in with the rest of that gang for me. And I remember thinking, what? Was there no one? Does he know somebody?
Huh. Yeah. I was thinking, and probably in the same film, George Clooney, because everyone else in that group is really attractive and good-looking and successful.
Unlike Clooney?
Yeah, and he just kind of sticks out like a sore thumb with his big face and his stupid eyes.
Oh, his big face and his stupid eyes.
His lovely ears and his huggable chest. What?
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, let's get back on track. I mean, some for me are the ones where you go back and you realise that someone who has later become famous is in a tiny bit part. Seth Rogen and Donnie Darko is one that sprang to mind for some reason. And even Tom Sizemore in Point Break, he has like one scene. Mm. But you're like, that's Tom Sizemore. Look, right there. Look, see him. Wow. Also, at the time, actually, Anthony Kiedis pulled me out of that because I was like, whoa, Chili Peppers. Anyway, but I would like to nominate more recently Richard Schiff in Man of Steel. And then there was like a little Battlestar Galactica reunion up in the Arctic scenes there, because both Gaeta and Hilo were working on the secret project in the Arctic.
Michael K. Williams in The Incredible Hulk. A proper blink and you'll miss him, literally. He walks out, looks, and it's gone. Doesn't even say a word.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, have you not seen that? When Hulk and Abomination are fighting down the street, he walks out of a shop, looks up, looks surprised, and it cuts away. And
really?
And that be Omar. Also, Bobby Brown was in Ghostbusters 2 as a doorman.
Wow.
Yeah. True story.
Again, I'm not sure if that is exactly what Simon Crook...
Well, you'd think it was a cameo, but then knowing Bobby Brown's career as it was, that was probably just a job.
He did the music for Ghostbusters 2. You know that. Come on now.
Nick knows that. Dean Norris in Total Recall plays the guy in the bar with the mutant face.
Dean Norris in The Counselor.
Dean Norris in Evan Almighty plays a cop. Really brings me out of that film. I was just so in it. And then there he is. I'm like, oh, rubbish.
Major Dean Norris fact. He plays SWAT team leader in Terminator 2 Judgment Day and SWAT team leader in Gremlins 2 The New Batch. Now, are they the same person?
Same universe. This is amazing.
I think so. Let's move on, shall we? Next question is from at the Pete's Bog, and this has been asked, we felt this back a couple of podcasts now, so your answer better be good. It says essentially we've been banging on about our favourite American TV shows for a long, long time. So what are our favourite British TV shows? Jolly good. Helen.
At the risk of making this sound like we held it back deliberately until this week.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to say Doctor Who. I know.
Sorry.
James doesn't
briefly.
Like it.
I actually, there was someone else asked a question about our favourite Doctor Who moments, and I knew you were going to be on the podcast this week, and I decided not to put it in. Yes. I have to say, I'm not a huge Doctor Who fan.
Okay.
Not a huge Doctor Who fan. I think we've said that in the podcast before, but I love the fact that they got Paul McGann back to do that.
That was great, episode. Actually. That was very exciting. And it doesn't mess up the numbering, so I'm going to go with conventional numbering in what I'm about to say.
Oh, please do.
Thank you. Because it makes... Right, okay, this is a slight spoiler for the 8-minute webisode that's online.
Night of the Doctor.
It confirms that John Hurt, who we saw at the end of the last series, is the 9th Doctor. He is the War Doctor, making him the 9th Doctor. Christopher Eccleston becomes the 10th, and
Taylor becomes the 11th.
David Tennant becomes the 11th, and Matt Smith becomes the 12th. We're just not going to go with that. We're just going to keep the traditional numbering, okay, because it's too confusing otherwise. So I watched it as a kid, hid behind the sofa. I remember back to sort of Tom Baker and Colin Baker and those guys, but I really started watching it under Sylvester McCoy. And
under Sylvester McCoy?
When Sylvester McCoy was...
It was so scary, he hid under Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah, he was playing the spoons and it made me feel
you
better.
You burrow under a Doctor Who actor while watching Doctor Who.
Anyway, and so he was my doctor when I was growing up. But he was my doctor when I was growing up. Yeah, very good, but not great prescriptions.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. I got through
it. You keep just running question marks after each suggestion. Penicillin?
Doctor, I keep trying to say something about Doctor Who, but I keep being interrupted by facetious comments. What do I do?
I don't know. I'm out of ideas.
As you were.
Thank you. So, and then David Tennant, as with virtually the rest of the entire world, was the one that really got me on board. I thought his stint was fantastic. I thought there were some great stories in there. James hasn't watched most of it, so has no leg to stand on. He's got his hand up, but I'm not handing over the mic.
James, a man who worships at the altar of Farscape, is about to diss Doctor Who.
You have... Yeah, okay. I'm the first to admit I watch a lot of rubbish television, probably more than all of our fair share of it. I just don't get Doctor Who. I really enjoyed it as a child when it was, a horror TV show.
It wasn't always
it was a horror show. When you got right down to it, it was a horror show.
No, there's a lot of sci-fi ideas.
There was
a sci-fi,
absolutely, but it's sci-fi horror. You know, there's a reason why it traumatised generations of children. And then it came back, and it was rubbish.
There are still
scary
episodes.
We can't get away from it.
No, I'm sorry. Like
the
Blink.
Only thing scary is the production values. I saw the Christmas special with Kylie Minogue. I saw the one where Billy Piper ran away from the mannequins. Honestly, this is like a nadir of British television.
Okay, but if you're only watching the Christmas specials, they're all style over substance. The best stories have always been in the series itself, and stuff like Blink... and stuff like the Pandemonium Open, the Pandorica Opens, were incredible. Absolutely brilliant TV. And frankly, honestly, it's a really good show now. Yes, it's aimed slightly younger than you might like, but it is genuinely witty and smart.
Is
and
it?
It deals with big sci-fi concepts.
Better than Supernatural.
Don't be ridiculous.
James, you should have watched more on your honeymoon.
You're right. I think if I'd watched more Doctor Who on my honeymoon, I probably would like it more.
My point is also, it's the 50th anniversary this weekend. It's big. It's here. It's very exciting.
And the Farscape box set is available now.
Luther, James and I.
Luther.
I've got a terrible joke involving Luther, which won't work on the radio, but let's give it a go.
Go on.
In the third season, this is such a joke. In the third season, you see him chomping down on the cereal. And it made me think, you could do any joke with Luther if you ask it this way. What is Luther's favourite breakfast cereal?
Ricicles!
Because if you shout it in the Luther voice, anything's amusing.
He's not wrong. The thing about Luther is he shouts people's first names multiple times in every sentence. I could be like, Ellie, what are you doing? Ellie, are you talking, Ellie? Come here, Ellie. So we know his name. We've established the characterisation. You can calm down. You know what? It's fantastic. The first season of Luther is genius. The second season is less genius and the third is less still. Nevertheless, it is never unwatchable. Idris Elba is a god. And Ruth Wilson also fantastic. I
watched the first season and then you pointed out to me because I was going, I can't believe I haven't watched this. And then James said, watch how he will every other word for no particular reason intonate it much more than he should.
Ali, where have you been today?
every other sentence, like,
I really enjoy listening to the Empire podcast.
I do love the show, and I actually have more love for the second season than you do.
Yeah.
I didn't mind how CSIE got, and I really like the final kind of coming together. But yeah, it's frustrating that and Sherlock with these three season kind of film length TV shows. It just kind of shows, it's great, but it kind of shows up our inability, or the Beeb or ITV's inability to create even six episode seasons now, because we kind of put all our eggs into one basket, and I kind of want more. I want six episodes.
Broadchurch, I think, was eight episodes, I believe.
I can't remember how many it was. Decent, though. That was good. That
made a bit of an impact. At the moment, if we're talking about shows that are on TV right now, I have to give shouts out to Yonderland on Sky One, which is fantastic. One of the funniest shows I've seen in a long, long time. In fact, we're in a very, very good time for comedy. But Yonderland is from the Horrible Histories gang, and they've basically teamed up, and it's kind of Muppets meets Mighty Bush meets Horrible Histories fantasy romp that is just as daft and as silly as you might expect. If you've ever seen Horrible Histories, and if you haven't, I recommend you check it out. Even though it's aimed for kids, it really isn't. And then there's Matt Berry's brilliant sitcom Toast of London, which is on Channel 4, and it's coming to an end this weekend, sadly, this Sunday night. And that is just daft and surreal and edgy and has the scariest Bruce Forsyth impression I've ever seen in my entire life. So do check that one out as well. And then going back, I mean, favourite TV shows? Blackadder, Garth Marenghi, Space.
Faulty Towers.
Monty Python,
Red Dwarf.
We could be here all day.
Although I will have to go in here. It's one of my favourite TV shows and one of, I believe, the greatest dramas ever is Tracker with Robbie Coltrane, which I roll out every time there's a list of best TV shows. It's astonishing. If you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have, watch it again.
Yeah. Now. And you talk about Luther, I've got a huge soft spot for Inspector Morse, which I think paved the way for these long, fairly cinematic TV shows and detective shows that, that followed in its wake. Love Morse.
Much like Hello, Hello did.
Much like Hello, Hello did.
Yeah.
The greatest of shows.
Indeed.
Also, it's not a drama, but I absolutely loved this year. Educating Yorkshire was a great TV show. The final episode had me in tears. And I think it was it last year? Utopia? I know I visit the set for it, so maybe I'm a little bit in the tank, but I thought that was a really brave, envelope-pushing, dark drama that Channel 4 did. And I couldn't watch all of it at once, because it really is quite grim sometimes.
Yeah.
But a great show. Check it out. Yellow Box.
And we can't talk about great British TV shows without mentioning MasterChef The Professionals, which is on right now. absolutely amazing. Michelle Rood Jr. at his finest. do check that one out if you can. It's on the iPlayer. Oh, and there's a show called Film 2013 as well.
Rubbish.
You might want to check that one out, especially last night's episode. okay, Nick at Nick Grimwood asks via Twitter, in light of the JCVD Volvo ad, what's your favourite TV ad featuring a movie star? Ali, I saw you did something on this.
I wrote a huge feature on this. My first feature is right for the website. And the first one I put up in the list of about 50 is Bruce Willis. Not the Sky one. Bruce Willis back in the 80s.
I like the Sky one.
Before he was a big deal. Before that one got banned. But before he was a big deal, he sang the Seagram's Wine Coolers song. And he is wearing, yes, a vest. And he's hanging out with his buddies drinking a wine cooler. And he goes, Seagram's Wine Cooler.
Amazing.
That man was to appear in Die Hard. And he's
was this
singing
before or after Die Hard?
About wine, before.
It's wine like before. Ross Kemp turned up that advert for Fruit and Fibre. Way before he was famous.
You can excuse the pre-Die Hard. The thing is, the Sky advert with Bruce Willis makes me sad. It makes me sad. It's actually better than A Good Day to Die Hard, but nevertheless, it makes me sad. My favourite adverts, just to jump in, is all of Arnold Schwarzenegger's Japanese ones. Have you seen the one for that little pop snap thing where it's just his laughing disembodied head going, ah! And you're just like, what the hell has this got to do with snacks?
Well, if we're talking about Japanese adverts, Nick Cage's pachinko adverts. Pachinko is this... I've been to Japan a few times. I've never understood pachinko. It's an incredibly noisy. They have pachinko parlors all over Japanese cities, and they basically go in and you have to... There are these games with numerous silver balls, and it's the loudest thing you'll ever go into. It's like a cacophonous noise, and I don't understand how to play it, and clearly Nick Cage doesn't either, but he did three adverts for pachinko that end up with him doing it in Nick Cage style, going pachinko and just loving it.
Luther?
I was about to say Luther.
Luther!
I was going to say the Arnold Schwarzenegger Japanese ads as well. A big sort of WTF to the Nintendo ads with Penelope Cruz and Nicole Kidman, which were trying to convince us that these incredibly glamorous women sit around all day on their Nintendo DS.
Or was it a PlayStation?
Was it? No, it was DS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was a bit like, no, I'm sorry, I don't buy it for a second.
Where do you stand on the current Dior advert that has Charlize Theron teaming up with a bunch of dead movie stars, including Marilyn Monroe?
I don't approve, first of all, because it seems a bit disrespectful to, for example, Marilyn Monroe's claim that she always wore Chanel No. 5 in bed, to suddenly have her, you know, shilling perfume for Dior. Seems a bit odd. And it seems a bit odd that I'm protective of what she shilled when she was alive at the same time. I realise that. But it's really weird. Like the Audrey Hepburn, is it Galaxy? It's one of the chocolates anyway, as well. It's just, no, let the dead rest. No, bad.
Sean Connery does an advert for Biogurt where he talks to a rabbit and then drives up a road and says, Biogurt. There's another great one involving Brad Pitt in Japan and he's in a tiny yellow car and there's a market.
Basically, they're all Japanese.
And it's really weird. In fact, I think you'd struggle to find an actor who hasn't done a ridiculous advert at some
point. But you can picture the conversation. Their agent comes to him and say, right, Brad, we've got a job for you. It pays $5 million. It will take you 3 hours. You'll look like an absolute knobend, but no one will ever see it outside of Japan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Except
now
we have YouTube.
Hell, yes. We'd take it.
Yeah.
The one that's getting me at the moment is the perfume ads. You know, we've had the Dior one we've already discussed. There's Natalie Portman doing Miss Dior, I think, and there's Keira Knightley doing one of the Chanels, where she jumps out a window and onto a bike and drives off. But it seems unreal that in the time it takes a man to walk across a room and turn a key in a lock, she's able to get back into her fitted cat suit, jump out a window and onto a bike.
That's the magical powers of whatever perfume it is she happens to be advertising at the time, Ellen.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry I didn't realise.
So there you go. There's people say they're talking about Japanese adverts, but it is becoming more prevalent as big stars coming over here and doing adverts. Obviously, we mentioned Bruce Willis on Sky. Al Pacino does a Sky advert as well.
I want a quick shout out for William Shatner in the Priceline adverts.
Oh, yeah.
The one with him and Leonard Nimoy. Is great, and there's another one which has another famous person in it. Anyway, watch them all.
And Shatner and Mr. T advertising Warcraft was pretty awesome.
Yes.
I don't play Warcraft, but those adverts almost made me want to think about not playing it.
And I loved Mr. T's Snickers advert, and I really like the one with Joan Collins at the moment.
Yes, I do too.
It's fun. In fact, there are American versions of those adverts as well, and Robin Williams is one of them.
Ooh.
Yeah, as an American football coach, and he turns out to obviously not be Robin Williams, but... yeah, check those out. All right, you can get in touch with us via the following channels. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. You can use the hashtag EmpirePodcast, otherwise we won't see it. We're on Facebook, Empire Magazine on Facebook. Do like us or throw a sheep at us, whatever it is you want to do. And you can email us podcast@EmpireOnline.com. Oh, and a particular thanks this week to Casey Bennett from Albuquerque, New Mexico, who, as well as presumably being a meth kingpin, sent in 20 questions via email for the podcast this week. Didn't get around to them this week because they arrived slightly too late, but we will answer them, or some of them, very, very soon, Heisenberg. Okay, time for our first interview. Stanley Tucci and Elizabeth Banks are two of the linchpins of The Hunger Games as it enters its second movie. Tucci, of course, is the peacocking TV host Caesar Flickerman, and Banks is a brittle and eccentric Effie Trinket. They're also, of course, two brilliant actors who've carved out interesting and diverse careers as two of the greatest 27%ers around. We sent Ali and Helen along to talk to them, and things got a little sweary. So if you're of a sensitive disposition, you might want to skip the first fucking 30 seconds or so. Enjoy.
Okay, so our podcast interviews, basically anything goes. You can go off on tangents, you can talk about whatever, you can swear, it's fine.
So just fuck F, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. 24/7.
Just,
right. Sure. That's not even a swear here, is it?
Nothing no. is a swear.
I know. It's hard to insult someone here. Yeah.
You can't be an alcoholic and you... and.
No, there's no such thing.
No such thing, really. I mean, they pretend, but no.
Sure.
Really.
Fuck is hello.
Fuck. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, fuck is just hello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, fuck.
So, fuck you and fuck you.
Yeah, yes.
Fuck Stanley. Fuck Elizabeth. It's great to have you on here.
Yeah. Sure.
Thank you, you fucking cunt.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's like a, that's, you just, that's the nicest thing you could say. Yeah.
I'm going to actually, I'm going to call up my mum and say,
right,
you know, Stanley Tucci called me a fucking cunt. So, she'll be really pleased.
She'll be so proud.
I always liked her.
My opening question seems quite tame now, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There is a bit in the film, Stanley, where you say the words to Jennifer Lawrence. You say, "Oh, girl on fire, you are a cheeky one," and then you laugh that laugh that I can't do. I was wondering whether you could help me do the ha-ha-ha-ha-ha.
Here's the thing. I haven't seen the movie.
No.
Really?
No, I haven't seen it. So
your teeth are amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. I grew them for the film.
I know.
What?
Such an accomplishment.
No,
he does it
no,
himself.
No, I would just slip them right in there. I don't know. Is that what I do? Is it like like that?
It's like when you see it in a comic book, they'd write it ha, 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 and you go, that's not real.
Right.
But then you make it real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just came out. I don't know. But maybe if you watch the movie a few times, then you can practice it.
It's the only reason I'll see it again, obviously. Yeah. Just
for that moment and that laugh,
I'll just leave after that.
Yeah.
I've got to say, I was going to kind of ask something similar because Caesar very much leads with his teeth. The first thing you see of him as he comes on stage is these blinding white teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Effie, I don't know if it's the eyelashes that are kind of her thing or just the dress. She always walks a certain way as well.
The walking is because I can barely move in the clothes. It's just the constriction of the construction of the clothing that requires me to only take 4-inch steps at any given time. But of course, that's Effie's walk.
But I really like the way you walk.
They're like no slits in anything, and I'm wearing, you know, I'm basically on stilts instead of shoes,
right?
Which I also am on today, stupidly. So it all comes from, you know, that little... the little wiggle.
It's great.
Also, I just like my ass. It's the best part. It's the best feature of my body.
It's interesting that isn't on the poster.
It's interesting, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. Fascinating.
Well, maybe the DVD.
I don't know what thought process went into that, but didn't feature it.
Right. Well, now the movie's not going to do well.
I know. You know, my nickname's Back It Up Banks.
Is it?
It is.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, I'm learning so much about
you. I know, right, Sally?
I really don't know you at all.
I know.
We met for a second.
Like a second.
When we were shooting the last one, but literally, it was my last day, and she was...
coming.
Yep. That was it.
I mean, how long did you both spend on set this time?
I have no idea.
I was only there for a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there a bit longer. But, you know, we're on a victory tour, so we've got a lot to do in this film. Effie's got a lot to take care of this time around.
Yeah.
You both, have your looks. I'm just wondering who actually takes longer to get ready in the morning. You got a little bit of pink in there.
Yeah, it takes a while. It takes a while. But we got it down to about an hour.
Yeah.
It wasn't so bad.
I'm,
it's not so bad.
How it's long disastrous
it
for me.
Is it hours?
I'm a 3 to 4 hours.
What?
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
From arrival to set, 3 hours minimum.
Oh, my God.
But it's all right. I'm the first one. I take a nap, so it works out.
in the middle of a scene.
I'm literally the first person in the trailer every morning.
There is a point in the film where you cannot see anybody else on screen. And I don't know the terminology, but the back of your dress
is so huge.
It's like a throne that comes behind your head.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it was a cape, actually, that we put up.
With stilts.
I think it has some very simple boning in it, but it was an issue on set because it was like, well, you can't see Katniss and Peeta, and they're they're pretty important to the story.
Kind of. Elizabeth,
but Effie doesn't
keeps
care.
Blowing over.
Right. Talk about upstaging.
Yeah, that scene stealing.
Scene blocking.
Full on with the clothes. Blocking everything.
So, I mean, we should actually probably touch on the film a little bit more. We're going to be talking to Francis as well.
Brother.
So he can do the heavy lifting there. But it is, it's a lot, you know, it's a cliche to say the sequel's darker, but, you know, the stakes are even higher this time, which seemed kind of impossible last time. And I think Effie especially has a bit of a kind of crisis of conscience.
Mm-hmm, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I call this the evolution of Effie. She certainly evolves. I think that at any given time there are people who are, all the time, people who are resistant to change, who love the status quo. Effie's very entitled to the life that she leads. And, she's really confronted in this film with the cruelty of the Capitol. It's very personal to her. I don't think she's ever had a victor. I think she's used to sending kids into the Hunger Games and they never come back. So she actually had not one but two victors, got to know them, was at the height of her professional career. And it's all taken away from her. So it's very, it really does become very personal in this movie.
I mean, there's the evolution of your character, mm-hmm. but Stanley, don't take this as an insult, but you get to just get in there for a week and ham it up, like really go to town. Was there any point where the director, Francis Lawrence, said, that's too much, can we have less of that? Or was he just like, go nuts?
The thing about this character is that he almost can't do too much, in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's so huge. I mean, obviously the tone has to be pretty consistent within its scope.
Sure.
But you know, he's so huge. I think you can go really, really far. And that was one of the things that really attracted me, you know, to it. And then once you put all the stuff on, you start to, you go even farther, and sometimes you just can't stop, you know. So luckily, I didn't go too far. Maybe on the next one,
You know, you don't meet very many capital citizens in these films. So Stanley and I, you know, we represent the excess of the capital.
Yeah.
You know, we are the manifestation of everything that's wrong in Panem. So you really can't go. I mean, the clothes they're insane. I mean, they're unwearable.
Yeah.
On purpose.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, it's just it's an exaggeration. It's where we could end up.
Sure.
In 50 years. Do you know what I mean? I mean, there are certain places, if you look at Caesar Flickerman or you look at, you know, I mean, there are people who look like that. I mean, you know, like go to Las Vegas.
You should go
to they look like, they actually do look like that, you know, LA. Yeah.
And also, I mean, you get the impression when you're watching Caesar on stage that he's, you know, he's actually kind of a professional, and he's getting kind of irritated. There's a little bit of sort of panic under the surface there when things don't quite go to plan, and you can see him kind of struggling to keep control of it. So there's layers there to his.
Yeah, there has to be. I mean, you have to see those little moments of humanity that he, you know. Otherwise, it's just it doesn't really mean anything. But everything's starting to fracture.
Yeah.
So, and we're, you know, I think that's the other thing that you see about these capital citizens is that there is fear there. You know, they understand there are consequences if it doesn't go right.
Yeah.
You know, we're on a very public stage in front of President Snow, and don't fuck it up.
Yeah, I mean, their fear in a weird way, they have everything to lose.
Yeah.
The other kids, they have nothing to lose. So they can really, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I mean, they're going to die or they're going to be poor.
Right.
And die, you know? So, I mean,
spoiler.
But these guys are on this very precarious, you know, like any, when you buy into any dictatorship, you're always walking on that very fine line.
And they're right under Snow's nose as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. Yes. Right there
in the spotlight.
Yeah. Yeah.
You, Sammy, have the most amazingly bad teeth in Jack the Giant Slayer, and amazingly good teeth. Mm. Was any of
good
that
good bad teeth?
Good, bad. Oh, yeah. The most excellent
right.
bad teeth.
Yeah.
How was that done? Was that like genuinely? I'm curious as to whether that was blacked out teeth or and
no. We make. I go to a guy who makes them.
You know,
we design them together. So I say, this is what I want. I want this to be like this, and this
it's an
tooth
art.
To be like this. Yeah, it's really fun.
Less on
and
the inside,
and it helps. I did it for the lovely bones too. I just changed. You don't really see them, but it just changed that little bit, the shape of the face and the way you talk just a little bit. You know, it's not really about acting. It's just about some sort of variety.
Trickery.
Trickery. That's all it is. You know, you put something in your mouth that makes you talk differently, and there you go. That's that.
And people go, wow, what are you doing?
What a genius. Yeah. Right, yeah.
You don't have a box of all your teeth.
A box of all my teeth?
Yeah.
No, that would be really disgusting.
That would be weird. It's Halloween. It's time for, I think, Hunger
They're
Games.
They're in a display case yeah. with lights.
Only my dentures, you know. But no. But it helps. That teeth thing really helps
it
me.
It all helps.
It helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's no Effie without the shoes.
Right,
you know? Right.
When the clothes.
Yeah, there's no Caesar without the teeth.
Yeah.
I would love to see Effie on her off day just wearing a pair of, like, tracksuit.
That never happens.
There's no off day.
There's no off day for Effie. Even the tracksuit is like sequined.
Were you tempted to dress up as these characters for Halloween?
Did I? No. That'd be weird.
Taking your
I
work
do
home.
Love how other people do that. I collect the Twitter photos.
Oh, do
yeah,
you?
I love it, sure.
What do you mean? People dress up as...
As Effie and
oh,
then
really?
Send me photos. Yeah, I'm
really?
Especially popular in West Hollywood.
Are you really? I bet. Yes. Yeah.
Wow. That's the first thing I'm doing when I get home. It's looking those
yeah.
up. Those
yeah.
Things.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And like little kids who do it, someone dressed their dog as Effie. Yeah, it was great. A real tribute to me when a dog.
Yeah. Hold the Oscar.
Yes. Yeah. Dressed up as Effie.
I hope it was a poodle.
It was not a poodle, but it was a cute dog. Yeah. They gave this dog pink hair and everything.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's great.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of Oscars, has Jennifer changed?
What is
yes.
that? Yes.
She's completely different.
Yeah.
She's horrible.
I don't even know what that means.
I don't know what it means. No.
I mean, she said herself, apparently, she was coming back on set, and she was like, right, people, you know, things are going to change around here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was
nobody.
It.
She has a pet monkey, and no one looks her in the eye.
Right.
Or the monkey.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
If you do it both at the same time, that's fine.
The monkey carries the Oscar around to remind everybody who's boss.
Yeah, and she never comes out of her trailer.
No.
Not even
she's CGI'd into
wow.
the film.
Yeah, she's not actually
she
even
doesn't.
In the film anymore.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
So many trade secrets
so
coming
bored.
Out here.
It's incredible. So bored, my publicist.
They're so bored. Both of them.
I know. So bored.
First interview of the day. And the boredom is...
I know. She can't wait till it's over.
So are we in the middle of the press tour right now, or is this the beginning?
Have you been doing
closer
stuff?
Closer to the beginning. Yeah, we're this is day four.
Oh, day four. Okay.
Yeah.
This is my first day.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're fresh anyway.
I'm fresh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't you tell?
I'm 3 days.
3 days in.
In.
Yeah. It sounds like a sentence. Day four.
Yeah. Mm. It's
your hotel room has four chalk
guys,
lines.
We love this movie. We're proud of this movie.
It's so great.
We can't
it's
talk
one of the best.
About it enough.
Yeah.
I mean, you've
yeah.
seen it. And that's how much you love it.
I yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's yeah.
Made sure
one of the best movies I've
really
haven't
is.
Seen.
Yeah. One of the best movies that yep. Stanley Tucci has never seen.
That's right. The tagline to go beneath the poster of mm-hmm. Effie's backside.
See it before Stanley Tucci does.
Yeah. Right.
I'm going to go even more left field than we are now, but we do something on the website on Empire Online, which is called the Movie Poster Mashup. Don't get worried. No, it's not like that. I know what you're thinking. It's not that. It's called the Movie Poster Mashups. Yeah. And what we do is we essentially, it's a riot of puns where we just take a series of puns and do what we can
so
do.
So clever.
I know, right? You know, we're Brits. We just love puns.
I love it.
We call it humor. Then we just go home. no, but there's something about your name, Stanley, your surname, which gives people great cause to pun.
Really?
Yes. As in, someone makes a good joke involving the Hunger Games, touche, touche, that sort of thing. I was wondering whether people, you know, play with your name like that, or is it just, you know, in say, you know, Film Geeks on our website?
I think it might just be Film Geeks on website, because I don't really know.
Oh, no.
No, I swear to God, I'm sorry, it isn't as... I don't know. I haven't...
It's not a thing.
Usually people just can't pronounce it, which to me at this point is like kind of weird. It's like...
What do they go for?
You know.
What do they go for? Tukey?
Touchy?
Touchy, yeah, touchy. Toothy?
Toothy
makes
sense.
Only in certain parts. So it's not really, you know. I was just in China, and that was so many different pronunciations of my last name.
Stop bragging, going to China.
Yeah, right?
How dare you?
Yeah.
Well, surely everybody's going to China nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
Big, important movie market nowadays.
Huge.
I've never been to China.
Huge. Don't worry about it.
Darn it.
Well, I mean... if this makes you feel better, I was at a Pitch Perfect ACCA along.
Yeah, you were.
So, you know, you've got your own.
Not little, in China, though.
Not in China, in London, but, you know, it's still international. So, so are you aware of this as a phenomenon? There were confetti cannons during the big finale.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
Where was
that?
That's
so awesome. This was at the Prince Charles. I love it. I'm so excited. Yeah, we do see a lot of, especially online. Everybody likes to share on social media when they're at their sing alongs. It's pretty great.
It was awesome.
Very excited about it. I produced Pitch Perfect.
Well, you produced it. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh, fantastic. It's wow, like my it's a life's shame work. It didn't do well.
Yeah, it's a bummer.
Oh, my God. My kids have seen it 8,000 times.
I know. And I also
it's
get
great.
To have
it's
a
really
fun
great.
Time in it.
Yeah, that's yes. great. I didn't know you produced it as well. Yes. That's wonderful.
As the producer, can you tell us anything about whether we'll see more of the gang anytime soon? What's the situation
We're
there?
Hard at work on a sequel, yeah. It won't be out till 2015. Yeah.
That's one hell of a year you're launching Pitch Perfect into. Pitch Perfect 2 into.
Into 2015?
Yeah.
Why?
You've got your Avengers. You've got
Superman
your...
Batman.
Oh,
Star Wars.
I know.
Perfect.
It'll be all right. It's perfect. It's a...
Well, it's the little
antidote.
Movie that could. So, yeah. Exactly. I'm promising a bunch of misfits. I'm promising more of our gang of misfits trying to sing.
I was going to say, will there be more singing from you?
Gail Abernathy McCadden so far has not sang in Pitch Perfect. I don't know. We'll see. She is an alumni of the group The Menstrual Cycles. Just one
so,
of the all-time
so you're
favorite.
Not gonna. So you're not. The it's very funny.
Yeah.
So you're not. You're not gonna sing.
I don't know. We haven't determined that yet.
Do you sing?
Not well.
No.
No.
Yeah.
It's not. It's not normally for public consumption.
Right.
Now they've got auto-tune now, it'd be fine. It wouldn't be a problem.
That's fine. I will completely embarrass myself if it sells more tickets to Pitch Perfect.
Right. That's how I make a living.
Right? That, by the way, that's what
that's
I'm doing
it.
Right
that's
now.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, well,
all it is.
No difference, really, yeah.
No difference.
No.
For me, it was a book I was totally unaware of. I mean, unlike Harry Potter, which when it came along, you went, okay, I've heard of this. But Hunger Games kind of blew me sideways. Have you been having people... coming up to you regularly in the street talking about this rather than your other films?
You know, I avoid the street at all times.
The street is bad. You do not like the street.
I just don't go to the street.
When was the last time you were on a street?
Ooh, it's been a while.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
They're getting good.
Streets?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're better now.
They're better
now. Yeah.
Look, I don't try to make contact, eye contact with like a group. If there's like a posse of 12-year-old girls.
Yeah.
I turn the other way.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I know what you mean.
A posse.
They're scary.
I know.
They scare me. Yeah. I remember being 12 and being like insane for things. It's scary. Yeah. And they'll do anything. They don't care.
Does it help that you look different to these characters?
It does. But they know instantly. I don't know how they know, but they know.
Yeah.
They know. I know what you mean, though. I know what you mean. Yeah. You're walking someplace. Especially if it's like with my kids or something. It's always a little, you know.
I love your use of the word posse. I just imagine them all with six shooters.
Well, the six shooters are now just their cell phones. That's what
yeah,
it is. It's
know,
just they all come out of their cases and it's like bang, 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 bang. But very sweet. I'm excited. Look, I love the passion of the fans. I wouldn't be doing this if they weren't that passionate. It's amazing.
Now, we've got to wrap up very soon. I was wondering if we could find a new word for goodbye. We've already nailed hello.
It's Tucci, obviously.
Tucci. Okay.
Tucci. Yes. So, Tucci. Yes.
Tucci.
Right.
Tucci. Tucci to everyone.
Right. Tucci, Tucci to everyone. Yes.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much.
Thanks,
you guys.
Thanks, guys.
Yep.
Awesome.
Awesome. Okay, let's move on to movie news. And there's a lot of movie news, not a lot of time to talk about the movie news. So let's talk about the movie news very quickly. Movie news.
TV news, actually, for me. I've got Helen. A double bill. I'm sorry. It's a case of giveth and taketh away today. for Neil Gaiman fans, at least. So Neil Gaiman's Sandman stories, which is a massive comic opus. It is absolutely fantastic. If you haven't read it, go and read it. You can buy the whole 9 volumes, basically, or get them from your local library. Or
my favourite is Thomas Hayden Church.
Yeah, I'm just going to ignore that. Or you can get the 4, you know, lovely, beautiful hardback editions, which I have. Anyway.
Nerd!
I know, totally. And one of them signed by Gaiman. Amazing. Anyway, so they've been trying to bring this to the screen for about forever. And it looks like there's another attempt coming. David Goyer, who is a man who can get this stuff done, is apparently behind a new version, which is in talks at Warner's. It would be for probably TV, but it looks like it might just happen. There is also talk, and it is only chatter at this point. It is in no way confirmed that they're trying to get Joseph Gordon-Levitt on board to play Morpheus himself, the Sandman.
This would be a TV show then, yeah?
This would be a TV show. It's all rumour right now, and it's, you know, we have no idea. But yes, that's the plan. Now, I mean, Warner's has been apparently courting Joseph Gordon-Levitt for basically everything, every superhero going.
Batman, would you like Batman?
Batman, no, would you like
Superman? No.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wonder Woman?
I mean, he's great. He's got cred. He's a good actor. And he also has, you know, his own sensibility and is a huge fan base of his own. So it's a really interesting idea. I think he could be a fairly good Morpheus, actually. Because he can do kind of brooding and, you know, romantic disaster rather well. I'm not sure it'd been my first choice, but if it gets it made, that'd be interesting. So that's the upside. That's the giveth part of the story.
So does the S in David S. Goyer stand for Sandman showrunner man?
That's
person,
right.
Man.
How do you personally, I mean, you seem quite positive about this, because when the whole Preacher thing came about, we were all a little bit mortified by it.
Mm.
And I mean, I certainly don't. I just feel that nothing good can come of that. And I'm not as big a fan of Sandman as I am of Preacher, so I'm surprised you're quite so optimistic.
Well, I believe optimism is always the correct default position at such an early stage. I mean, the issue is, what the heck do you do with Sandman? Some of the best Sandman stories barely feature him. And so you'd probably be focusing on the ones that do, which are in some ways, you know, a little bit less exciting and less what made the comic what it is. But, you know, I think there's scope for doing something kind of cool. And the overall arc of the character is a really, really fascinating one that hasn't been done on screen and hasn't, could be up there in sort of Breaking Bad levels of, you know, epicness, I guess. So I think there's probably a story there that could be told brilliantly. Whether it will, you know, we'll have to see. I don't know. But yeah, I'm intrigued. The take of the way part of the story, by the way, is the less positive news that HBO is no longer developing Neil Gaiman's American Gods, which is a bit of a shame. I thought that was a really good fit of you know, channel and material. But I guess with, you know, several other really big ticket shows in development, notably Game of Thrones, they might feel that it kind of overlaps on that territory a little bit. And, you know, fair enough, it's going to be another very expensive show to make, right, I would imagine. So that's apparently going somewhere else, and we're going to see where that is. But I've still got my fingers crossed that will happen, because that, I think, is actually more suited to the screen, maybe even than Sandman.
We didn't talk Preacher last week, did we? That's come to light in the last week.
It has, yes.
That's very true. We should talk about it now.
Yeah, so the Preacher TV show that's been announced on AMC with possibly Seth Rogen's involvement. He tweeted something last week saying, hopefully something I've been working on for the last 7 years is finally going to happen. Then about 30 minutes later, Preacher was announced. And then about 25 minutes after that, Seth Rogen tweeted, "Arseface, Saint of Killers, John Wayne." We were all characters in Garth Ennis's and Steve Dillon's amazing Preacher comic book series. Helen, it is my favourite comic book of all time, and is something I've long wanted to see brought to the big screen. And I say the big screen because I don't think the small screen can do Garth Ennis's vision justice, especially on AMC. Yes, they're the network that did Breaking Bad, but they won't be able to go where Preacher goes. They just won't. They just can't. And they should leave it alone.
But in a film running time, you wouldn't be able to cover a fraction of that story.
I think you could do a trilogy. You could absolutely boil it down. But in terms of the content of Preacher, I just don't think that AMC, any network apart from say, maybe HBO or maybe a Showtime, would allow someone to go to the places that Preacher goes.
I don't know. I think AMC, I don't think you give them enough credit. I think Breaking Bad took it to some interesting places, and I think The Walking Dead is absolutely vile a lot of the time.
It's not a question that it's also a question of language. Preacher is a very, very sweary comic. Garth Ennis is a very, very sweary Northern Irishman. Probably one of the reasons why I like him so much. But I think that's an integral part of the language of Preacher.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And AMC is the network that allowed Breaking Bad one fuck a season, two in the early stages and two towards the end. I just don't think you're going to get the poetry of Cassidy, the Irish vampire, for example, across in a sort of somewhat neutered environment.
I think that's fair. But if they were to class, say, Scott Glenn as Saint of Killers, I'd be happy. So that's good.
I believe he's been practicing for the role for the last 35 years.
And we can all agree that Seth Rogen will make an excellent arse face. So that's good too.
I love the comic book so much. If you haven't checked out Garth Ennis's Preacher and Steve Dillon's Preacher, let's give props to the amazing art by Steve Dillon. 66 issues, that's all it is. So you can go out there and read it all.
I do love comics with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Like Sandman.
Like Sandman and Preacher.
Absolutely. Like Spider-Man. Ali, what do you got?
I've got a bit of news that was then rewound like this and was no longer made news, but it's still news in its own way. It's a Wonderful Life. There was a sequel planned. The trouble is, they don't have any official rights from the owners of both the original source and the film itself, Paramount. No one sent them a letter. There was no request made.
I've read a story about It's a Wonderful Life 2. And I think the rights situation has changed, and it is back. The rights are held by someone now, and so it is difficult. Apparently, you know, I read a story in the Hollywood Reporter, basically said it's not going to happen. A bit like the Raging Bull 2 sequel, that we talked about in the podcast a while ago. That just went. It's not like if anyone listened to the George Romero podcast recently, he talked about how the rights situation for Night of the Living Dead, he never really owned the rights to that, and so he's been stiffed on it over the years. And that is in the public domain. If you wanted to go out today and make your own version of Night of the Living Dead, you could absolutely do that. I don't recommend it, but you could do that.
The thing is about this one is that they wanted to call it It's a Wonderful Life, the rest of the story.
That there tells me that they have the creative insight that can make this fly.
Yeah. Producers... I don't even want to say. It's just, I just don't see it
happening.
Let's
just not.
I think it's just like, as you say, it's just like Raging Bull 2, and I think it's a bit like the Queen / Freddie Mercury biopic, where it won't necessarily be that they own the rights to the film, but there'll be some character or the name or whatever will still be in rights.
There will be bells and angels with wings, or not.
Like Constantine.
Yes.
Ali, you've got some big news, huge news.
It is huge. It's certainly huge for me, and it's huge for anybody who knows what the words Eric the Half a Bee mean or Hell's Grannies. Monty Python are back together again, reuniting like Led Zeppelin for a one-off O2 show in London Town on the 1st of July 2014. You can buy tickets for their one-off show, which is called, in typical florid Monty Python fashion, Monty Python Live. It does have a subtitle. The subtitle is One Down, Five to Go. And there's a great, great drawing which has a graveyard and the massive foot you know and love. The massive foot is there, stomping on a grave in the graveyard. And in the corner, there's a white angel with a kind of go-go dancer's legs and little red shoes. Anyway, so yeah, they had a special announcement ceremony at the Playhouse Theatre down near the Embankment in London, which is where, surprise, surprise, Spamalot is currently on. You can see Warwick Davis do his thing there. And he actually was the host of the press conference, and all five of them had a lot of fun because I was lucky enough to be there. But they all sat down where their names weren't. So John Cleese sat in Terry Gilliam's place. And whenever somebody asked a question from the crowd that they didn't want to respond, they just took the question for the other person. So Eric Idle goes, well, being Terry Gilliam, I've been doing absolutely appalling animation for years now, and I thought I might just do some more one last time, that sort of thing. So, yes, there's a question mark to be drawn at the end of this sentence, and the sentence being, really?
It's a long sentence.
Because they're old. They're in their 70s now. Like, they last did a show in the Hollywood Bowl in 1980.
Which is fantastic, by the way.
It's a stunning audio album. I grew up listening to the records of all of their...
I grew up watching the VHS. I taped off the telly.
Tape off the telly.
It is amazing. Torre Melinos and all that sort of stuff.
Do you remember that, kids, taping off the telly?
Do you remember VHS, children? No, you don't. Do you remember Laserdiscs? I'm hugely excited about this. I am even going to forego if we get tickets for this. I imagine hopefully they'll add another couple of days, because I imagine these tickets will sell out on Monday in about 5 nanoseconds. I am even going to forego watching 2 World Cup second round games which clash with this Monty Pythonathon on the 1st of July 2014. I thought I might be able to squeeze in the 5 o'clock, but I definitely will be able to watch the 9 o'clock game. And that's how much Python means to me. That's how much this reunion means to me. It's fantastic. Python back together. This is what we've been wanting for ages. We've had Eric Idle in this very booth. I think between the two of us, we've managed to interview all the Pythons over the last 12 months or so. And not an inkling, so you spoke to them all yesterday. When was this on the agenda? So whenever Terry Jones said to me in Derby back in May that they're not going to reunite, was he telling me Porky Pies?
Well, I think it was genuinely recent. Michael Palin was telling me it was within the last 2 months they started concocting the idea. And it wasn't one of them that said, hey, we should do this. One of their managers, who I forget the name of, just said in the middle of a meeting, because infrequently, and I love this idea, they meet up in a restaurant in a hotel and they just sit down and have a conversation. And sometimes it's just to see how each other are. But for the most part, it's just sorting out finances and stuff. So Michael Palin said to me, yeah, one of their managers said the O2. And everyone went, hang on, that's not a bad idea. I got a more frank response from a certain Mr. John Cleese, who said, we owe our lawyers about £800,000. And we've got a few more debts that we have to pay off. So there is that.
That's amazing, though, because you imagine that they're just all rolling in cash. Terry Jones, because this was revealed in a newspaper, I won't mention because it's a rag, but this was revealed a couple of days before the announcement was made at the press conference. And Terry Jones was quoted as saying, it's a lovely idea. I hope you make a lot of money. I want to pay off my mortgage. It's just, I find it unfathomable that all the Pythons aren't rolling in cash, obviously with the exception of Graham Chapman, who's ruled himself out for the foreseeable future.
Yes, he's a no. And they won't be replacing him. There's not going to be for tonight, Eddie Izzard will be playing the role of... That's not going to happen, and they're not going to bring in guest stars. That isn't their plan. They want to keep it kind of a refreshed and kind of tweaked versions of the greatest hits. And it's with great pleasure that I actually reminded Terry Jones that, you know, I said to him, please, I was a really big fan of Hell's Grannies, and I don't think it gets enough credit. And he said, do you have a pen? And I didn't have a pen, so he had to go up to the nearest just person in the room and just said, a pen, 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 and then just wrote in capital letters, Hell's Grannies.
Right.
So if that's in the show,
right,
I'm taking full credit, because they forgot to put it in.
That's amazing. So it's going to be some new material. It's going to be a lot of old sketches. I'm intrigued to see how they fit Terry Gilliam in, because obviously he wasn't a big part of the sketch troupe, necessarily. Are they going to do bits from the movies? Are they going to do... Because essentially Python, Grail... Life of Brian, Meaning of Life, especially Meaning of Life, are basically just sketches strung together by the loosest thematic thread.
Well, as I said, you know, 1980 was the last time they really performed together, sketch-wise. And if you remember your Monty Python dates, 1983, so that's 30 years ago that the Meaning of Life came out. 30 years ago, which is astonishing for me. That came out 3 years after that. So they haven't used stuff from that on stage shows.
Yeah.
So they are planning...
Every Sperm is Sacred could be...
Every Sperm is Sacred.
They're going to do that.
Yeah, and I don't want to reveal too much because, you know, we're going to be writing at length about this, but there are lots of stuff that film fans, fans of the Monty Python films, can look forward to. I've got a few details here and there. And yes, singing will be involved. And it's funny to hear them, because I said to Michael Palin, so, Michael, how's your singing voice? And he was like, yeah, so pretty good. Anyway, so yeah, Chris and I are very excited. And
I'm so very jealous of you yesterday. I was in a very warm hall in Coventry watching snooker while you were meeting all of the Pythons.
Yeah, it was an incredible day, and I really can't.
For you, it was an incredible day.
It was terrible for them.
You can't be any more clear about this. It was an incredible day for you. I was watching snooker in Coventry, which was fine. I saw 3 century breaks. It was okay. But you met all the Pythons.
Yeah, probably won that day.
So yeah, do look out for more details on this in the mag.
In the magazine, yes, the one on sale December 31st, because we're perverse, and that's the way we work in magazines. But you can also read some the transcript of the press conference, is that correct? It's going to be on the website?
The press conference is actually available in about 14 different video locations on YouTube.
Okay, well, there you go.
So you can check it out there. Anyway, here's to that. Apologies for maybe nerding out a little too much.
I don't think we nerded out enough, to be honest. We'll have to have a Python special around the time. We'll have to get them all in. Oh, my God, how good would that be? And by the way, the tickets go on sale 9 o'clock Monday.
Monday, yes, and the website is called, and again, this is genius, MontyPythonLive.com.
Please don't go on until 9:05 just to give Ali and myself a chance to book some tickets.
That would be great. The lowest ticket is £27.50. The most expensive ticket is up towards the £90 mark.
My incredibly quick story is a monstrous exclusive, something which came crashing out of the blue, and it is incontrovertible proof that the astromech droid R2-D2 will be in episode 7.
We have
photographic evidence of R2 on set with director J.J. Abrams and Kathleen Kennedy. In other news, space will continue to be a black vacuum and planets will often be round.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I heard that the trash compactor's agent is holding out for a bigger deal.
I heard this also.
Yeah. So fingers crossed, I really hope we get to see him back in action.
I really cannot wait until actual Star Wars news arrives, as opposed to the whole internet scrabbling around for things like, oh, there's a colon in the title, there's a colon. Yeah, honestly.
Don't you get me started on the colon.
The colon was quite controversial. Like maybe a bit of casting.
Have they put a colon on R2-D2's name? Is it R2:D2 now? Have they done that?
They're still sticking with the hyphen. There was a time where it was leaning towards an M dash, but I think it has gone back to hyphen levels.
Thank Christ for that.
The one slightly interesting thing about this is that the R2-D2 they will be using is a fan's or two fans' own creation.
Yeah, that's really cool. But they've got their animatronic R2, which I think we've probably seen at Comic-Con. I remember seeing it there 1 year. Yeah. It's awesome.
I don't think Kenny Baker agrees with you.
Well, perhaps not.
I'm sure Kenny Baker will be involved.
Yes, I'm sure
at some point.
He'll be operating the remote control.
He will be. All right, moving on?
Sure.
Okay. So next week, it's Thanksgiving in the States, so we're expecting the movie news to be few and far between. So if anyone there out there can just send us in some games or something we can play, maybe some quiz up again, we can do that live on the podcast. That'd be quite fun. Okay, time for the second interview now. Francis Lawrence has directed some of the most eye-catching music videos around, including Britney Spears' I'm a Slave for You. Am I correct on that?
Yes.
Yeah. Although his feature career has been something of a mixed bag, Constantine has its detractors, but also its fans.
Me.
Hello, Helen and me. I'm Legend did well at the box office, but not critically, while Water for Elephants highlighted the growing need of Water for Elephants. But he bagged the gig to replace Gary Ross in the director's chair for Catching Fire and subsequently its two sequels, Mockingjay Part 1 and Part 2. And we sent Helen and Ali along to talk to the director that nobody but nobody is calling F Law. Enjoy.
So first of all, we really, really enjoyed the film. I mean, you're coming into something which the first film's already been a massive success, and you've now got to both honour what's gone before and carry on that kind of tradition, but also bring something new to it. So what was the first kind of challenge, I guess, in taking this on?
The first thing that I really had to think about when I got the call about meeting with the producers was whether or not there was going to be enough for me to do. That I was going to have enough sort of creative freedom, because I'd never taken on a sequel before. I've never done an episode of television after somebody's created the world. But I very quickly saw that there was going to be plenty of room for creative freedom. You know, there were certain things I was going to inherit. There were some aesthetic choices that were made in terms of the world creation, the way District 12 looks, the way the Capitol looks. There's a cast that I was inheriting, but it was a fantastic cast. I mean, you kind of can't ask for a better cast. But I saw with the material when I reread the book that it's a very different story, and there's a lot of new room to sort of maneuver with the characters, and that is the story. It's the story where the themes for the book series really start to kind of emerge and blossom, and that we start to see the effects that the games have had on the characters and the damage sort of being around violence and partaking in violence has done to them. And we start to explore, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and the entire world opens up. You know, the stakes for Katniss open up, the mythology and the stakes for the nation, and you know, we get to create a brand new arena that hasn't been seen before. We get, because it's an anniversary year, we can see more of the Capitol and build new parts of the Capitol. We go to different districts. And so it just kind of kept, you know, building and building and building. And suddenly I realized, okay, well, the first movie was kind of a starting point, but now like we can really kind of open it all up and go from there. And then there's also a new cast. So there was loads for me to do and to sort of sink my teeth into. And then I got really excited.
All those themes that you've mentioned there, Now, we had news this morning that there's going to be, in the works, a theme park of The Hunger Games. Are you in any way involved? And how do you imagine the themes of alienation and indoctrination? And
you know what? I have no idea. I mean, literally, as everybody heard on the news, that's when I heard on the news. So I have, yeah, I have no idea yet. I mean, I'd be very curious to see what people's ideas are. I'm not an expert in theme parks other than I like going to them. So, you know, I'm down to go to a Hunger Games theme park.
I see it as being like a really, really fierce crash. You got a tough kid that just isn't playing ball. You take him to the theme park. All right, you're going to the Hunger Games now. I'll pick you up in an hour.
Yeah, that's hilarious. That sounds more like one of those like child labor camps or something. Than...
Exciting new direction for theme parks. Though,
yeah,
so that could work.
No, I'm sure that the people are coming up with something really kind of fun. And I also know that Suzanne is really cautious and careful, you know, because she wrote books that are about something really important and something that she really cares about. And so I think that she would make sure that there was a really smart and tasteful way that it would be presented. You know, I don't think she would let it happen.
Did she have a lot of discussions with you about this book, or did you go to her?
I did. Yeah, right when I got the job, I had a nice long conversation with her about the story. And one of the first things I did after that was fly to New York. And I was just going to sort of sit with her, meet her in person, and kind of pick her brain. And what ended up happening was for about 3 days straight, we sat in this room in the publisher's building in Manhattan and just went through the book. I had made all these notes about the book, and we went through the book and went through my notes and created this beat sheet for the screenplay. And then gave it to the writer and sort of started to build the screenplay from there. So it was a great kind of way to dive in and immerse myself in the world and be with, you know, the true expert of the world.
Wow. And did you do the same for Mockingjay in that case?
Cause yeah. And that all worked really well. And she was really involved in the development of the screenplay. And she, you know, would visit occasionally, but she sort of, once the screenplay, everybody's kind of high-fiving about that, she sort of backs off. Although she's welcome anytime, she's great. But sometimes actually what she would do is she would actually come down to Atlanta where we were shooting to visit, but to work with me on the weekends for the beat sheets for the next movies. And so we did a fair amount of that, and she actually wrote some treatments for the next movies, and then that's what we sort of turned into the screenwriters.
Are you aware what Jennifer Lawrence's favorite music video is that you directed? And could you guess?
I'm going to guess... Britney Spears, Slave for You?
100% correct.
Okay.
That's genuinely impressive. I was wondering whether she was tapping you on the shoulder a couple of...
No, she has this weird thing where like somehow something will get brought up and then I'll say, oh, I did the video for them. And she goes, no way, which one? And then I'll tell her and she's like, why is it every video I know and love you did? Right? And I just... You know, I can't quite tell if she's actually just being nice and friendly by saying this or if somehow truly like... I've happened to be working with the person who like knows those videos and loves those videos.
She was talking about a streak when it was like Jenny from the Block.
Yes.
And there was a bit of conversation there where I said, you know, obviously J-Lo. And she went, yeah, people call me that. No, I didn't mean that.
I call her J. Larry.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, it's better than J. Law, I think. J. Larry. And I actually got that. There was a guy that used to call me Frank Larry. See, this is the sharing the last name thing. Somebody used to call me Frank Larry. And so I started to call her J. Larry. I think J. Larry should catch on instead of J. Law.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah, that was one of the questions I was genuinely going to ask, because it's very hard for us when we're writing features about the film, because we would tend to just use people's surnames, and we obviously, Lawrence is just too confusing.
Well, you can just do what everybody else does now, which is just put no relation next to my name.
That's your full name now.
Yes, Francis Lawrence, no relation.
Yeah. It's important to know that.
Yes, Lawrence has become my middle name.
I've got a couple of curiosity questions that aren't explicitly to do with this film, but hopefully you wouldn't mind indulging me.
Okay, depends on the question, but...
Should be quite simple, hopefully. Okay. Constantine is getting a TV series.
Yeah.
Do you happen to have any thoughts you might want to give someone who is trying to make this into a TV show? Retrospectively, would you have any hints and tips about what to do and what not to do?
My big tip, and I don't know that much about it. I did hear that they're making a TV show. I think it's a great idea for a TV show. I hope it's for cable. I'm not sure if it's network.
It's NBC.
Yeah. Okay. That's my big problem with it right there. Constantine is nasty, right? And I'll give my advice here. I was making a big movie. We made a PG-13 movie. We got hit with an R rating. I got totally screwed because if I was going to get an R rating, I could have made a hard R movie, right? I could have really earned the hard R movie. I would have made the hard R movie. It would have been a better movie. But instead, we have this kind of watered down PG-13 movie with an R rating. It deserves to be an R-rated show. And it should be on cable. And it should be dirty and cynical and nasty.
People should be smoking.
All the time.
Constantly smoking.
Constantly smoking all the time, as long as he's paying the price for it.
Yep.
But he's like kind of a horrible guy. He's not a very redeeming guy, and that's kind of the fun of Constantine. And I don't know how horrible a guy you can be.
Mm. And everyone needs to be from Liverpool.
On NBC.
Like everyone.
I agree.
Just to fix it.
I agree.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Good. I'm glad we cleared that up.
Yes.
And this is
Were you a Hellblazer fan?
My brother is such a big fan. Like, he's such a big fan that if I didn't ask you, he'd be upset.
Yeah, no, and my movie was a giant disappointment to him.
You know what? He's not even that guy. I know guys who are that guy. No offense.
Yeah.
But my brother's not
No,
that
I
guy.
Got it. Believe me, I got it. I was like, I got hit hard by the fanboy stick on that movie.
It's a heavy stick.
I like it.
Yeah, that's
I'd like to go on
record. A lot of people do like
really
it,
really
but I know. But Keanu's not blonde and British. That was it. Done.
Done. Yeah.
Yeah.
it's hard to win.
Yeah.
If only Sting was available.
How about Tilda Swinton is an angel? I'm
no,
so there.
No, I know. The cast is actually in Peter Stormare. It had a good cast.
Yeah. Speaking of fanboys, in the weirdest twist of fate, Batman and Superman is happening. Is happening? It's happening. Mm-hmm. And there was an Easter egg in I Am Legend for it.
Yes.
How does that make you feel? Was that a strange thing? Was it when it was announced, or did you see it coming?
No, I mean, you could sort of see it coming. I mean, especially with the success of Superman. And the success of the recent Batmans, you could definitely see it coming. We didn't see it coming when we did that moment in I Am Legend. The reason it's in I Am Legend is because Akiva Goldsman, who is the writer of I Am Legend and one of the producers, wrote one of the original drafts of Batman versus Superman for Wolfgang Peterson. So there's a whole, you know, if you go back into the history of all the Batman Nolan movies and Superman with Bryan Singer and like Tim Burton and all those guys when they were going to do it, that was like way back then there was a Batman Superman movie that was going to get made and it didn't. And he thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool if we put this poster up because this is supposed to be in like 3 years and, you know, and we got permission from Warners and we put it up there.
And yeah, and that's been what it's been for the past 3 years. People just going, there's it, that's what it is, that's as close
yes.
we'll get.
Yes.
I am a big OK Go fan. I know we're running out of time here, and I was just wondering, after you worked with them for Get Over It, can you take all credit for all work they did by themselves afterwards, you know, with their treadmill stuff?
No, those are actually some of my favorite. They've done two of my favorite videos of all time. I like the one that I did with them, that was kind of a fun one, but their treadmill video and their Rube Goldberg video are great. I wonder, did they do them themselves or did the Singer do them? I think the Singer did them. I think he like choreographed them and all that, but that treadmill one was pretty inspired, I have to say. You know what? That's the kind of idea that has to sort of be born from within a band because, you know, when you're selling a music video, right, and you got to write a treatment and you send these pictures for reference and all that, you're like, I'm picturing it all one shot and you guys dancing on treadmills. It's like, I don't think, you know, many people would go for that.
And just very finally, I've got to ask, what are you planning for November 2015 when you're finally done with all three of these?
Oh, hopefully I'm going to go on a very long vacation. A very long vacation. I've already been talking to my kids about it. Unfortunately, they probably can't take off that much time from school, so we might have to wait for the summer, but we'll do something fun.
Very,
but I'm
going to
sleep a lot.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you very, very much.
Cool. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Lovely man with lovely hair.
Indeed.
Right, time for the review section. It would be perverse to start anywhere else other than The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, so let's start there, because I'm not perverse at this time of the morning anyway.
Oh, well, first time for everything. So The Hunger Games: Catching Fire sees Katniss Everdeen, Jennifer Lawrence and Peter Mellark, Josh Hutcherson, back in District 12 after successfully surviving The Hunger Games last time. Spoiler. But they're soon sent off on what's called a victor's tour, where they have to go around all the other districts and kind of parade themselves in front of everyone. And on that tour, they become aware that there are serious rumblings and unrest all over the country of Panem, and that people are beginning to feel rebellious towards the capital. They don't help, actually, because they say a few nice and sincere things, which of course actually fuel the flames of rebellion. And then the two of them come under serious pressure to kind of put those flames back out at the expense of their lives or their families' lives if they don't. So that's all gone a bit pear-shaped as far as the capital is concerned, and they're determined that that Katniss and Peeta will not become sort of magnets for insurgency. And the way they decide to deal with this is by putting them back into the Hunger Games arena for another go-round. It's the 75th Games. It's a 25th anniversary. You know, every 25 years they have what's called a quarter quell, and they have a big special event. And that means that this time they're going to only send winners back into the arena. Now, in District 12, there are only three surviving winners ever. That's Katniss, and there has to be a girl, so she's definitely going in. And then the only question is, does Peeta go back?
It's fixed, so she goes in. What's that
what?
About?
I'm sure President Snow, played by Donald Sutherland with a really sneery voice, wouldn't do that, Chris.
No, of course not.
So it's either Peeta or Haymitch will be going in with her, and they will be up against people who have survived the Hunger Games before, who are very tough, very scary, have incredible skills, and are also, you know, in quite a few cases, at least borderline insane. So it's scarier than ever, and the stakes are higher.
I don't remember very much about the first film. There was a bit where Joss Hutcherson disguised himself as either a tree or a cake. I can't really remember.
A cake
made of trees.
He did.
But yeah, but I really enjoyed this one. I thought it was gripping. I thought it was serious-minded.
Yeah.
I think it's quite a good thing that this is going to be potentially a billion-dollar movie the second of the year, because it doesn't treat its audience like idiots.
Yes. I completely agree. I think it, I mean, the first one I liked, but I didn't go nuts for. This one I thought was much, much better, actually. Mm. You know, partly some of the heavy lifting in terms of world building had been done in the same way that the first two Harry Potters were a bit plodding because they had to explain what all of these things were. I think the first Hunger Games had a little bit of that going on as well. And now Francis Lawrence is able to do what Cuarón did and kind of just go for it, just tell a story, just focus on the actual drama of the situation and the characters rather than having to explain what the heck this is.
Mm. This is funny, I actually much preferred the first one. I mean, we've both read the books for these and they get progressively worse as they go on. I think simply by virtue of repetition, and the second book's basically a spin on the first one and the third one's a spin on the previous two. I prefer the first book, and in this case I do prefer the first film because it has a purity to it. You know, there's a setup, there's a resolution, and I think the arena stuff in the first one is slightly more feral, slightly more, I won't say battle royale, but it has that feel about it. Whereas in this, it feels rather more cartoony, rather more comical, and not quite as, you know, life and death.
But at the same time, I think what's good about this one is that they don't get into the arena for well over an hour.
True.
And the arena stuff is a lot shorter than it was last time. So that, I think, deals with some of the problems that the book had. Because I agree, the second book did feel almost cynically like a rerun of the first. Whereas this one, I think they kind of earn it a little bit more and they spend a lot more time, you know, going into depth into what this world of Panem is, what the pressures on this society are, you know, what the stakes are for everybody involved, and why everyone is under pressure to keep things, you know, the way that they are. And I think that worked really, really well for me, that you didn't just feel like you were being thrust back into the arena and it was the same thing over again. It felt like there were different things in play this time.
Having said that, I was slightly disappointed you talking about how Katniss and Peeta are going up against former victors, and they're more feral, and they've won, and they're committed, and they're smart, and they're dangerous and savage in some ways. We don't really get that confrontation, not really. And I can't go too much into that, obviously, because they're plot machinations. Mm. But the threats in the arena tend to be external, or put there by the Hunger Games designer, who's Plutarch Heavensby, played
That's
by
right.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, who
He's
has a Hunger
very
Games
good.
But there's, you know, there's poison fog, and there
are baboons,
huge baboons, and there's all sorts of other threats that don't come from the competitors necessarily.
Well, yes, that's true, but I think that's because one of the other changes is that basically, and this is I think what's kind of interesting about these books, because even the third book, for all its flaws, highlights that this is a series about trauma as much as it is about anything else. This is a series where no one gets away clean. And Katniss, in particular, is just more and more traumatized by her experiences. And Jennifer Lawrence does a really good job, I think, in this film of showing exactly how damaged she is, and Peeta, and Haymitch, and all of the victors. And I think that's one of the big strengths of the arena for me. This time, the big change is that there are many more alliances, that Katniss is in with a group, that she's not solely on her own in the arena. And I don't think that's too big a spoiler to say.
No.
But that does change the dynamic. And yes, you're right, you don't have quite as much, you know, her against the world as you maybe did in the first one. But I think you need to change that up somehow.
Am I the only one who sees this series as Republican propaganda? It seems to me a series entirely about the horrors of big government and the importance of autonomy on a local state level. I think really that's the subtext we should be looking
for. No, I don't think so. I think it's the horrors of authoritarianism and not
necessarily. That's what they want you to believe.
I, for what it's worth, thought this was pacier, more fun, more gripping, more entertaining than the first one. It licks along at a great pace, and in retrospect, there is a chunk that we talk about actually in a special spoiler section, which you can read about in a feature that's online on empire9.com with Francis Lawrence, where he talks about what changes he made to the original book and costume design and all that sort of stuff. So do check that out if you have watched the film and you're curious. But yeah, there's a bit which kind of disappears, where suddenly time is sped forward because of the necessary need to keep things going.
Yeah.
But I also felt that relationships kind of were a little quick to develop in a way that maybe as a novel reader Helen might be able to explain better.
There are some flaws. I think it's a very, very good film. There are some flaws. I think it suffers from middle-itis in that it's the middle film.
True.
In a trilogy or a quadrilogy. By the way, I've been going to the bookstores all week ripping copies of Mockingjay and 2 just for extra authenticity.
Thanks.
Yeah. For some reason, the bookstore employees aren't happy.
That's weird,
isn't
it?
I'm really trying to help them out. But this film, for me, doesn't end. It just stops. And that was a slight problem, but because I was kind of going, well, it's building to a big finish, and then it kind of doesn't really. And I guess Mockingjay Parts 1 and 2 will be the big finish.
Yeah.
But also, I have issues, and I know you don't, Helen, but I have issues with the central love triangle that powers these movies between Katniss and Peeta and Gale Hawthorne, played by Liam Hemsworth. I don't think that those guys are well-drawn or well-defined enough to make her choice, make her dilemma believable.
Here's my thing. She doesn't have a dilemma at this point. She basically doesn't care. All she's focused on in these first two films especially is staying alive and keeping her family alive and those she loves alive. She doesn't have any real... I mean, she says actually on screen, and I believe her, she doesn't have any interest in lovey stuff right now.
No, I agree.
And,
absolutely.
And so she cares about both of them. You know, Gale is her friend since childhood. They've always had this closeness and this kind of relationship. Peeta and she have been through this, you know, incredible experience that no one else can really understand, and that's driven a wedge between her and Gale and brought her and Peeta closer together. But ultimately, she isn't interested in forming a relationship with either of them. So to say that the love triangle doesn't work, I would say, is a compliment.
I think you're actually right. I don't think the love triangle works as a central narrative device, primarily because it isn't one. I don't think it is in the books either. I think people have made it into more than it is because of the whole Twilight thing.
Yeah.
But it's very marginalised, I think, in print. I mean, Gale's not in it enough to form part of a love triangle.
He's not, but what I'm saying is that there's a development, a late development. Again, we can't really talk about this too much, but there's a late development that I just didn't buy. It comes out of the blue. I don't think the film has invested enough time in the in that side of the character or characters to make certain developments fly. That's just my personal take on it. I know the film doesn't revolve around a love triangle. It's got much, much bigger fish to fry. But I think if you're going to have a major plot development revolve around something like that, you really need to make it work a little bit more.
The script was in part written by Michael Arndt, who will... he did Little Miss Sunshine and Toy Story 3, and he's an Oscar winner, and he's obviously involved with Star Wars Episode 7 up to a point.
Or was.
I thought the script for this was very, very tight. I have not read the book, but I thought it was really taut, and they slip in... You were talking about not being patronised as filmmakers, not patronising their audience. They slip in very important facts very subtly, and they're kind of here, there and everywhere, planted very nicely. I was very satisfied by this film. I walked out and I went, I cannot wait to watch the third.
Yes.
I cannot wait to watch
this. Yes. It's a frame.
Baboons.
Plus baboons. It's a very intelligent, gripping, well-made, at times grim movie that has a lot of surprises. And Jennifer Lawrence is absolutely phenomenal. So it is worthy of the 4 stars. There's a great conversation early on between Donald Sutherland and Katniss, which is not the sort of conversation you usually find in a movie like this. And it's just really well acted.
To hear her use the words, not hear her, but to read her use the words, "Fishu!" and Nyar. Read my interview with her, which I transcribed and has put up on the website, empire9.com. She is absolutely wonderful, really, really charming. She jumps out of the page. So you do check that out if you're a fan of hers.
And she also does talk on our video interviews about centipedes, so check that out as well.
Not human centipedes, because that would be upsetting.
Christ, no.
4 stars for The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Next up is a film that took Cannes by storm this year. They had to basically invent an award for the two actresses in this movie. They didn't give them the best actress to these two actresses, but they had to invent a special award. They were so good. It's since been taken along as a very, very, very dark horse for the Oscar race. Sadly, I think it is. It's Abdelatif Kashish's Blue is the Warmest Color, starring newcomer Adele Exarchopoulos. Okay. It's Abdelatif... Fuck you. Fuck you. It's Abdelatif Kashish's Blue is the Warmest Color, starring newcomer, and please give me a drum roll for this one, Adele Exarchopoulos. Hey! Thank you. Given my track record for pronunciations in this program, that was a tough one. And Lea Seydoux as two rather intent lovers. Ali, you were in Cannes. You interviewed these ladies.
Yes, and it was a great pleasure to do so. They are both prodigious talents, and I really hope they get the opportunity to go on and on and on and do other things. Like the newcomer, Adele, is... She's breathtaking, both as an actress and as a beauty. But you may...
Very lovely, Adele.
You might notice that... You might recognise Lea Seydoux from the beginning of Inglourious Basterds.
Also Mission Impossible 4.
Also Mission Impossible 4. Who could forget Mission Impossible 4? Yeah, so this is the story, which in French is called... It is a French film, just to make this clear. La vie d'Adèle, chapitre 1 et 2.
I should translate that for you. The life of Adele, chapitre... chapters 1 and 2.
So with a film that has in its title 1 and 2 chapters, you know, this is a movie that's 3 hours long, and the overwhelming sensation as you watch it isn't just that that is a very intimate lovemaking scene, which is possibly what it's most famous for, but that scenes run on very long. The director, Kashish, really gives space and room to breathe for these characters to feel real and to... It's a coming-of-age story and a realization of sexuality tale between a high schooler and who is kind of coming to terms with her sexuality, and then a with blue in the hair older girl,
a bohemian
no less, who kind of helps her explore that sexuality. R. Ian Freer, who reviewed it for the magazine, absolutely adored this film.
It was his film of the year. And it is his film of the year, unless something happens.
Yeah, well, yeah, a lot late contender could no, it won't. It is moving and sweet and real. There have been some difficulties with the director not being happy with how it was been portrayed in the media, is that right, after it came out?
Well, there's been a bit of a war of words between the two actresses and Kashish. Basically, they say that he was quite rude and quite mean on set. And, for example, the sex scene, which is 7 minutes, I believe, out of 3 hours. A lot of people are focusing on it, as indeed we are now. But at the time in Cannes, there was an awful lot of speculation that they had done it for real, and they haven't. It was entirely simulated. There was that scene took 10 days to shoot, for example. He was very, very specific about what he wanted, and he was very, very harsh and tough on the actresses involved. And in certain interviews, they've said that they weren't entirely happy with that. But I think there's been some rapprochement since between the two of them, or between the three of them. And I think all is okay in the Blue is the Warmest Color camp. And in fact, I think Adele Exarchopoulos and Kashish are going to work together again.
I'd hope so. There's obviously something there, whether it's difficult or not. It's obviously working. This, of course, won the Palme d'Or, lest we forget.
Yeah, and as I said before, the Spielberg and the jury created a special category to reward Exarchopoulos and Lea Seydoux for their performances, because they're fantastic. They're so intense, and they're very lived-in performances, and especially from Exarchopoulos, whose name I won't stop saying now I can pronounce it properly. And she's just absolutely fantastic. Mesmerising, in fact. We give this 5 stars. It is... our film of the week in terms of quality. Do check it out if you cannot get in to see The Hunger Games Catching Fire, because I imagine there'll be lots of queues. And this one for a French art house release as well. It's going fairly wide around the country.
And it deserves it. So do go and see it where you can. And like I say, remember it's 3 hours long. Just bear that in mind.
Indeed, indeed. Not a bad thing, of course. Today, November 22nd, marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States in Dallas, Texas. Thankfully, it falls on a Friday, which means it's a perfect time to release a movie about it, isn't it, really? It's not cheap or tawdry or cashing in or sensationalist at all. That movie is Parkland, which purports to tell a tale about the other people on the fringes of the assassination that day. So there's Lee Harvey Oswald's brother, Robert, his mother, the doctors who try to save Kennedy's life, including Hunky Zac Efron. There's the Secret Service agents in shock at losing him, including Billy Bob Thornton, and the man who took the most famous amateur film of all time, Mr. Abraham Zapruder, played by Paul Giamatti. So, thoughts on Parkland. James.
I thought it was an interesting attempt to adapt the famous song by Blur. I'm not sure it was entirely successful. The subject matter, to me at least, was quite surprising.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be a bit more sort of Cockney Britpoppy, but no, you know, they moved it to America, and I think it went very well.
Paul Giamatti as Damon Albarn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zac Efron shouting "Park Life."
That's good.
Yeah.
It's good. The little pint of milk I was looking for, and he didn't turn up at any point. That was quite distressing.
Okay, you haven't seen it, have you?
No.
Okay.
That works on about half a level, but yeah, Parkland is a bit of a mixed bag. I think it's fair enough to say it's interesting that it's not directly dealing with it. I suppose that's to be rewarded, but it's patchy. I think it's fair to say.
No, it is somewhat patchy. We gave this film 3 stars, which I can only imagine was a result of a sinister conspiracy involving the mob, the Cuban government. And the CIA.
The reviewer has since been shot in the head.
The reviewer, yeah, back and to the left, back and to the left. This film is not very good. It is very, very cheap. It's very dull. I'm going to recycle a line I used in Film 2013 this week. It's not just, it shouldn't be called Parkland. It should be called Parkaland because it's so dull. It's just basically an anorak of a movie. It's because it's such an exciting subject. It's such an interesting idea. People on the fringes of the assassination, the doctor is trying to save JFK's life. That's an interesting story. I'd like to see more about that. Robert Oswald, who has to watch as his world falls apart, as his brother is suddenly named as the guy who allegedly killed the president. And there's... I've been watching Oliver Stone's JFK too much. And these are interesting characters. The problem is the movie is 91 minutes long, which is approximately half the length of Oliver Stone's JFK. And it doesn't have the depth or the shade or go into these characters very, very much. We're introduced to Zac Efron as the hunky doctor who tries to save JFK's life on the operating table. He's the only surgeon available in Parkland Hospital, which is where the film takes its name, when the president is brought in. And we're introduced to him basically, we get an idea that he's a bit of a ladies' man. He turns around with a bit of a nod and a wink and he pinches someone's bum. And then after that, we get no sense of him at all as a character. He's just trying to keep this guy alive on the operating table against all odds when bits of his brain, Jackie Kennedy literally has bits of JFK's brain in her hand. He's not coming back, people. Spoiler alert. And after that, we get maybe one more glimpse at this character as he's trying to save, 3 days later, Lee Harvey Oswald's life on the same operating table. But apart from that, you don't really get a sense of any of these characters. There's a bit at the end where it comes up on the supertitles at the end. It says Abraham Zapruder never really got over the shame of filming the Zapruder footage, which is the only footage we have of the Kennedy assassination. But there's no real sense.
He sold it on, didn't he?
Well, it was kind of taken off him by the Secret Service and the CIA, and he kept a copy for himself. But I think he felt very... he didn't like the focus, being at the centre of so much attention from the government, from other people. But you don't really get a sense of that in the film, even though he's played by a very, very capable actor in Paul Giamatti. It's just a very, very patchy film. It feels a little episodic. It's written and directed by Peter Landesman, who's a journalist turned filmmaker. Let that be a lesson to all of us, frankly. There are some things in this movie that I thought were very interesting. There's a sequence where the Secret Service are transporting JFK's coffin back to... on what was then, I guess, a version of Air Force One. I'm not sure if Air Force One existed back then, as it is now, but it was their private plane. And they couldn't fit the coffin onto the plane. They had to saw bits of the plane away to get the coffin onto it. And they were, the handle of the coffin breaks off in front of Jackie Kennedy, and she's distraught, as you might expect. This is mere hours after the death of the president, because they rode roughshod over Texan laws to take a body away from Texas to take it back to Washington, which I guess is one of the things that's fueled some of the conspiracy theories over the years, that there was never an autopsy performed by the medical examiner in Texas. And they bring it back onto the plane, and they have to rip seats out to fit the coffin onto the plane, and that scene is the best scene in the movie. But there are some very, very weird directorial decisions by Landesman, who chooses to have Jackie Kennedy be a character, but she's on the periphery of things. Almost, in fact, that you really only see her face once or twice, and I think she only has one or two lines, and she's glimpsed in the background of shots, almost her back to camera an awful lot, almost as if it's like the Ed Wood situation where Bela Lugosi has died and has been replaced by a stand-in. It feels very, very strange, and it feels cheap. There's a bit where Zapruder is watching the procession come in, and he sees the assassination, and the camera stays on Giamatti throughout as he goes, "Oh my God, here comes the president. Oh, he looks great. They've killed him. Oh, they've killed the president. Oh my God. Oh, this is awful." And it's just, this is so bad. This is a radio theater. So yes, 3 stars for Parkland. 3 stars, as we always say on the podcast, is a recommendation. And now the family.
A Luc Besson comedy thriller about a mob family who relocate to the south of France but can't stop their old scheming, murdering ways. It stars Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer and Tommy Lee Jones, which means it's got to be amazing.
Right, so the story of this one is that a member of the mob, can you guess who it is? It's Robert De Niro, that's right.
Yes.
He snitches on the mob, and it turns out that the mob does not like it when you snitch on them. He gets put into witness protection and is bundled off to a variety of places and ends up in...
the south of France.
The south of France, with his wife, Michelle Pfeiffer, and his two kids. And so that's fine. Tommy Lee Jones looks after him, in a manner of speaking, as kind of the watcher protector within the witness protection program. But, and this is the biggest surprise, his past catches up with him. And this also means that it gives the team behind this movie the opportunity to yet again, and I can't... If someone could actually count this up, the number of times Robert De Niro has ridden roughshod over his past as a cinematic legend within mafia movies, he watches Goodfellas in this film.
He does.
Which is just, I think, maybe a step too far for me. And I think is quite indicative of the tone and the general attitude towards what's gone before. And it certainly doesn't match up to the likes of Goodfellas.
No, it doesn't. I mean, this would be a fairly generic setup for an action thriller, and I think if they'd taken it as an action thriller, it might have quite worked because we all know Luc Besson, he can do action. But this movie makes you weep. It makes you weep for people's cinematic legacy. So obviously there's Luc Besson, but there's De Niro as well. There's Michelle Pfeiffer. They decide to play this as a black comedy, and it's very, very cack-handed. It's very monumentally misjudged. None of the jokes are funny. I think I'm all for black comedies. I love black comedies, but I like my black comedies to actually have comedy. And this one just completely gets it wrong. All the characters are reprehensible. Again, nothing wrong with that. Goodfellas is seen in this movie, is referenced in this movie. None of the characters in that are likable. They're all horrible people you wouldn't want to be stuck in a lift or the trunk of a car with. But yet, the writing, the acting, the characterization is compelling. None of that works here. It's just dreadful from start to finish, which is not to say that all the performances are bad. They're not. It's just it has this horrendously misjudged tone from the off, and it has one of the worst "you must laugh now" comedic soundtracks. Aha, someone is being beaten with a baseball bat, but we have jolly music playing at the same time, so you know it's funny. It's absolutely horrendous.
I have a really big problem with I both love it and hate it with cheeky music in films. So kind of just like cheeky stuff, it'll be like and that sort of thing in this film is, oh, it's just heartbreaking. So what number of stars do we give this one?
We gave this 2 stars, but I think I personally would have gone with 1 star. James has literally just beat me a quiz up while we've been reviewing.
I have literally just answered Chris's quiz up challenge to a Star Wars quiz, and I think it's fair to say pwned the shit out of him.
I think okay, maybe.
Crushing the thing. Sorry.
One thing I will say is that it's all over adverts these days, and it's on the side of buses and stuff, and it looks like it might be fun. It's not. Sometimes you can persuade yourself that, you know what, I'm going to give it a crack. No, is our thought, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There are scenes that lurch from alleged comedy to violence in a heartbeat, and you're meant to be laughing at the violence in this movie, as Diana Agron from Glee, as De Niro's daughter, because the joke is that the kids in this family are as bad as the parents. And, you know, she beats people up. A guy tries to come onto her. And she beats him and his friends up with a tennis racket in a really, really horrible way. And you're just going, oh, really? Okay, am I meant to be siding with these people? Because, frankly, I'm not. So 2 stars/1 star for the family. Also out this week is a micro-budget mockumentary, Computer Chess, which we gave 3 stars to. And Danny Dyer takes on a gang of geezers, what burned his parents, though they did, in Vendetta. And we get that 2 stars. It's better than most. Danny Dyer goes after some South London gangs, what burned his mum and dad to bits films, which I think is all of them pretty much. But it's actually not too bad.
And we gave that film 2 slags.
It's a proper naughty film that got 2 stars out of 5. So you can check it out maybe on DVD if you're a Danny Dyer fan, or if you're Danny Dyer. Who knows? And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by screenwriting legend and owner of possibly the best voice to grace this booth so far, Mr. Joe Esterhaas, screenwriter of Basic Instinct and Showgirls, will be in... Well, he was in this booth. He was in this very chair, in fact.
There you go. And get your swear jars at the ready, because Helen and I will be talking to Colin Farrell, star of Saving Mr. Banks, and the air will be filled with fecks, crumbs and blimeys and other harsh, unforgivable swear words as our Irishness meshes to offend your delicate sensibilities.
I don't think it's going to match Stanley Tucci, I think.
I think the gauntlet has been laid down.
I mean, seriously, who ever thought that Stanley Tucci would be the man to drop the C-bomb? And not only that, say it directly at me.
To be fair, the man has a point.
I mean, obviously, he saw the truth and he told the truth. Yeah. I appreciate
that. He calls it like he sees it.
Yeah.
To be fair, we drop a C-bomb at you pretty much every day.
Just not on air.
Yeah. Because we're refined like that.
Oh, refined.
We are. Okay, so until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Bye now.
And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to queue for spam, 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 bacon, eggs, bean, bacon, spam, spam, Monty Python tickets, spam, spam, and spam. See you next week.